show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams, my co-host. Sandy, you predicted that there was going to be a time soon when they were going to be clamoring for negotiations to kind of bring this war to an end in Ukraine and in Russia. And it looks like, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, former members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and even present members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff are saying to Ukraine that it's time to kind of bring this thing to an end because of the what could happen if the wrong thing happens. We'd be right on top of, you know, World War III and nuclear war. And that was talked about early on in this, Sandy, but and then it was quieted down. But now the Joint Chiefs of Staff are saying,
yeah,
that we're getting into an area here that is so serious. Because what could happen is with the weapons that NATO keeps giving and the United States keeps giving, Russia can be forced into a situation where they say, and especially now where they're starting to reach Russian land, and now the Russian people, you know, can be harmed. Well, early on in the war, that wasn't the case. The war was taking place solely in Ukraine.
Well, I guess I never thought that there would be a public clamoring for peace negotiations, but I have always thought that there would be private back-channel pressure that would begin to build, particularly from the people like the chiefs of staff. And I think it's because there's certainly a knowledge within the intelligence community and the State Department diplomatic community that Crimea and Sevastopol is very fundamentally strategic to Russia, and that would constitute a red line. If the war shifts into the Crimea, and if it appears that Crimea and Sevastopol could be returned to Ukraine, the two red lines that I see that are undoubtedly have been laid out by Russia are, one, that NATO that not be expanded to include Ukraine so that there will not be military bases, which might include nuclear missiles, in Ukraine, representing the NATO nations, and that Ukraine be essentially a neutral nation. And two, a red line would be that Sevastopol, in particular, and the Crimea, which is the land where Sevastopol lies, continue to be part of Russia after the annexation that occurred in 2014. Sevastopol has long been, since Catherine the Great, has been important to the Romanov Empire and then to the Soviet Union as the warm water port on the Black Sea, the only warm water port that Russia has. And so it's very fundamentally strategic. And I think that the problem that is seen now is that with the success of Ukraine in the battlefield, and now Ukraine is talking about shifting its sights toward the Crimea and toward Sevastopol, there's a realization that that would ramp things up substantially with respect to Russia and the actions that Russia might be willing to take in defense of that. Furthermore, the current situation for Ukraine in the battlefield is one of relative success, and so that a negotiation which could start now might reflect a fairly extensive amount of leverage on the part of Ukraine with respect to what they could negotiate for. I still believe that a negotiated settlement will end up looking a great deal like what I was talking about, which could have been the settlement that I was talking about when Russia simply had Ukraine surrounded by troops and had not yet invaded it, and that is that that Ukraine agreed to its neutrality and not becoming a part of NATO, which it was willing to do within a month of invasion. Zelensky announced that he was willing to go there, and two, that the Donbas region, in some respects, be treated differently than the rest of Ukraine in terms of its relationship to Russia.
So what some of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were talking about, Sandy, is Russia eventually firing weapons or dragging the European nations into this if they feel as if the support that the United States keeps giving and the European nations keep giving, that they say, well, listen, okay, you guys are the reason we're in the situation we're in now, because this had nothing to do with you, and now, you know, we're suffering, Russia, even though we're the invaders, but you stuck your nose in it, and now financially our country is suffering, and so we'll just expand everything.
Well, I think it's fairly complicated, and I think that the main risk, the hugest risk, is the notion that there would be nuclear weapons used. And I think what's been demonstrated in the battlefield right now is that NATO, as a unified force, is more powerful militarily, absent use of nuclear weapons, than is Russia operating unilaterally on its own. Now, if Russia can enlist the aid of China, so that China and Russia are a combined force, I doubt whether China would be interested in engaging in a war with any part of the European Union. China's biggest trading partner is the European Union, I believe. Or at least vice versa. I think China is European Union's biggest trading partner. I think that what's really of concern here is the duration of the war, the duration of the sanctions with respect to how long and what damage that would do to Europe. Now, incidentally, the heating season in Europe is working out much better for the Europeans than was expected, and the gas price crisis and the gas shortage crisis that was predicted, Mother Nature is sort of solved for Europe. And so that has weakened Russia's negotiating posture as well, which is another reason I think the Joint Chiefs might be saying now is the time to talk to Russia, because Russia's sanctions, the promise they had that sanctions would be weakened because of the problems in Europe, aren't working out the way they thought. But I come back to the notion that Sevastopol and Crimea is really important to Russia, and that the nature of the war that Russia would be willing to wage over that exceeds the nature of the war that they are currently waging with Ukraine. And by that, I don't really mean nuclear weapons. I mean the use of massive land force and the price that they would be willing to exact from themselves for that is much greater than the price they're currently willing to exact for Ukraine.
You know, Sandy, we can talk about what we see with Ukraine and the damage that's being done. I was watching something the other day, and they were talking about they basically are without power in many areas. They go to bed with candlelights. It's 2023, Sandy. We understood, but
no power, no heat. There isn't a heating. There is no heating system that doesn't require electric power, other than fireplaces or potbelly stoves. And so, the loss of infrastructure in the modern world is catastrophic. You lose water most frequently. Water has to be pumped, and unless you have reserve power somehow that's going to keep all that working, that doesn't work, and you lose heat, and you lose light. And so
let me ask you, Sandy, does it make sense to continue this battle? Knowing, and I'm not Ukrainian, right? And I'm not one of the Ukrainian people. And Sandy, while you know the suffering that the people are dealing with, only going to get worse, because Russia they see this weakness as far as destroying all of that. And even, let's say, they survive that. How long is it going to take to even repair that? You can't even begin to start repairing that until after a ceasefire.
Well, the problem here is the end of game analysis, right? And so Russia is looking at this, and the end of game analysis for them is as difficult to see as it is from our side, because the more they destroy Ukraine, what happens after they succeed in a war of taking over Ukraine? I mean, if they take over the Ukraine, a country that they've totally destroyed. It's going to be a very expensive endeavor. So I suspect that they've come to the conclusion that they don't really want to take over Ukraine anymore because, number one, it's they've unified a national spirit there that would be very difficult for them to contain with an occupying force. And number two, the physical expense of taking it over with respect to rebuilding it would be extreme. So, you know, we're getting to a point where the end game is pretty clear in terms of how it should play out and how it could play out. But we have to understand, I guess, what it is that Russia is demanding as the condition for laying down its arms. And Ukraine, you know, as a Ukrainian, you obviously aren't going to lay down your arms until you understand that you're going to have safety and you're going to have your own country and your own government, if that's what's important. If you've decided that that's what's important, and I suspect that was probably less important to more Ukrainians on February 23rd of 2022. Than it was on February 25th after the invasion, and it's probably much more important today, after 10 months of this, than it was on February 23rd a year ago. So, you know, the Russians have, through the invasion, created a process which makes the end game for them more difficult and more likely that a negotiated settlement involves preserving the Crimea and Sevastopol for them, doing something about the Donbas region and a neutral Ukraine. They used to want a change in government. I'm confident they aren't going to get that.
And some form of restitution. I don't know if that's something that they can ask for or demand, and whether or not that will be a non-starter. I don't see Russia, you know, paying some form of restitution.
Well, the problem with restitution is frequently it involves, like when the United States is restoring Europe, they would like send Bechtel Corporation over to rebuild it, right?
Right.
I'm not sure how happy Ukraine will be to have Russia's version of Bechtel Corporation occupying major regions of Ukraine in order to rebuild it.
Hold on, thought, Sandy. We got to go to the break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. You know. At 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, I wanted to get back to this last segment on Ukraine and where do you think this is the prelude to where they're actually going to begin these discussions for real?
I believe that there are probably back channel discussions of a sort going on right now, if only between intelligence agencies, you know, CIA to FSB or whatever. There are some kind of back channel signals being sent. I think that this Christmas armistice that was proposed by Putin, I think I told you off the air, I think that's probably more like the the boxer who spits his mouthpiece out so he can get a rest. I think it's kind of a little bit more of along those lines in terms of being disingenuous and more of a publicity PR move than one of sincerity. But I do think that both sides have both reason for discussions. Russia probably is a little less inclined to move into discussions right now because they're negotiating from something closer to weakness. I think that Russia was hopeful that the winter would kind of, with the sanctions problem in Europe and the gas shortage and gas price issues, would cause Europe to be weakening in its resolve and would be a better time to negotiate. Like I said before, Mother Nature sort of vitiated that problem. And so the inflation rate in Europe is actually going down. It's single digit. The price of gas has gone down rather dramatically. It appears that there will be plenty of gas for the rest of the winter, unless the winter falls into some precipitous deep freeze. And so Russia's strength in negotiating is not being improved by waiting. And so maybe that will in turn cause Russia to decide they'll come to the negotiating table anyway now. I think it was going to wait until all of those things played out in Europe and they felt they had a stronger negotiating hand. It doesn't look like it's playing out that way.
Sandy, let's change gears. Does Southwest Airlines survive?
I mean, survive at all?
Yes.
Yeah, I think this has got to be a phenomenally difficult financial pinch for them. They're giving away 25,000 travel points, which is the equivalent of $300 worth of travel, I think, to everyone who is dislocated. I haven't seen anyone do the math as to how many millions or hundreds of millions of dollars that is, but I'm confident it's a huge number. And so this is obviously going to put a big dent in their current revenues, and it'll put a dent in their future revenues as people cash in those points and take advantage of the free travel that would be derived from it. Airlines operate at a pretty slim margin. Southwest, before this, was one of the profitable airlines.
Right.
It had a business model that was really working. Unfortunately for them, that business model was premised to some extent on flight scheduling and flight locations.
A house of cards.
But it was flight locations that were more vulnerable to the kind of problems that were experienced in terms of being able to move their airplane from place to place and solve for problems. They had more scheduled flights per airplane than the other airlines, which was one of the reasons they had higher revenue, but it now gave them more problems when they couldn't move their planes around as they would want. And so, you know, they were hit far, far worse in terms of cancellations than any other airline. In fact, in the last week of cancellations, when they would announce the thousands of cancellations that were occurring, they would say fundamentally that all of these cancellations were Southwest Airlines. And so it will be very hard for them. I'm sure that analysts who are covering the airline industry are watching carefully Southwest Airlines, and their creditors are probably a little worried.
You know, the lack of pilots. They clearly stated we didn't have enough pilots to go. I don't know how you can schedule flights, and I do know, as you well know, you can't predict the weather, but why were they hurt more so than American, all the others that were able to somehow survive the bad weather and their model was different?
Well, I think their model included a geographic area that was more impacted by the weather. Okay, so their flights tended to be long distance flights, nonstop from either coming from or going to a place that was badly hit with this weather problem. And one of the problems with airlines is you have to be able to move the airplane back to where
right.
it needs to be. So it isn't just flying it there, it's
right.
flying it back. You
right.
know, you end up with all your planes in one place. Doesn't help you in all the other places. And I think that's what happened. Southwest ended up with all its planes at the ends of their flight courses that were in good weather, and none of them where there was bad weather. And they couldn't make up for that. And I think they are not totally different from the other airlines. I think there is a serious shortage of pilots generally.
Santander, hang on. We got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Phone lines are open. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Let me. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, man, you know your stuff, because going back 6 months ago, there was all this conversation about we're heading to, there's going to be recession and it's going to be horrible and inflation is going to do this, and we're going into this major recession in 2023. I don't know, Sandy. The more you look at things now, even though the Federal Reserve has continued to push the interest rates, you know, the inflation is down, it's moving in a downward trajectory. I was almost 100% sure that we were going to have this major recession. And you were saying, I don't see it. I mean, I'm not saying that we're out of the woods yet, but.
Well, I never, you know, I think my what I was saying was that I wasn't at all sure we were going to have a recession, that the while the tea leaves lined up in the direction of thinking it could happen, the fact is that inflation is a psychology. And if you can break the psychology early in the process, if people don't really believe in their soul and heart that prices are going to go up inevitably in the future, then you can break inflation. And you can see that people haven't really believed that. The housing bubble broke pretty quickly. The rate of increase in houses stopped, and in fact, it has chilled. And in most places, the price of housing is going down. The price of used cars stopped going up and went down. There's a number of sort of bellwethers of things where people can buy them either now or later, and those are good bellwethers to tell you whether there's an inflationary psychology or not. And most of those things, the price has stopped going up and has started going down, automobiles and houses being primary examples. So it could well be that because of the long-term nature of the non-inflationary economy we had, people don't really believe that inflation is an altogether likely outlook in the future. And then when we had the Federal Reserve Bank announcing that they were going to do what they could to fight inflation, you know, we've been able to begin to curb inflation without creating any additional unemployment. So, you know, the notion was, you know, my view is that we're going to have a chilled economy without necessarily meeting the indices of a recession, and we aren't going to see less an increase in unemployment because of the friction we have and we experienced in the last 3 years, where lots of people were laid off because of COVID, lots of people backed out because of COVID, and now when we're looking for people to work, we can't find them. And the lesson was learned by the employers there, and the whole labor market has changed. And people are holding on to workers, people are training workers, and the labor market has seriously changed, and people are beginning to pay their workers more. And, you know, some said, well, that's a harbinger of future inflation. We're going to have a wage price spiral, wages pushing prices up. And God help us, but it could be possible that we'll have wages going out without inflation or without material inflation. And so, you know, maybe we'll come out of this with the soft landing that people were talking about. I'm not predicting that either. I'm just saying, look, this looks like a possibility. And if the more it looks like a possibility, the more it might become one.
So is the rest of the globe experiencing what we're experiencing, or is the rest of the globe going to be headed into recession? And if they're headed into recession, what can they drag us into?
That's our risk. And you know, we've talked about decoupling from the rest of the world. Decoupling from the rest of the world will create inflationary pressures in our country. It'll be much harder to contain inflation if we've decoupled and if we have basically a self-contained economy. It's much easier to have shortage. It's much easier to have wage price spirals. All of the issues that lead to inflation are much harder to control the smaller the economy gets that you're dealing with. The world economy and globalization had almost everything to do with the low inflation rates that we've experienced over the last 25 years. And so if China has a serious recession, and if the European Union has a serious recession, it will impede the American economy to the point where it could push us into recession as well. We are not immune from what goes on in these other economies. And the more we try to immunize ourselves from that by becoming self-contained, the more likely it is that we will develop problems within our economy that are harder to deal with. So my hope is that we will not reverse globalization in all the ways that it has
been beneficial.
And it has been beneficial in keeping the peace in the world, too. The more we compartmentalize economies, the more or less interdependent we are. The less interdependent we are with China, the more likely it is that we will have friction with China that could be very, very damning and damaging.
Well, you know, Sandy, and I see you, Tom, we'll come to you. China is having and experiencing some kind of recession fatigue. And so it's part of the European...
Oh, yeah, and parts of Europe have gone into what is under every indices called a recession. People are predicting that England and Great Britain will suffer maybe the most. Some of them are pointing at Brexit as one of the reasons for why Britain will experience a deeper recession than the rest of Europe. Interestingly, Brexit is just the kind of compartmentalization, the decoupling that I'm talking about, that will be a danger for America. Brexit was the decoupling of Great Britain from the European economy, and it is going to cause them problems now, and it will cause them problems in the future, just of the nature that I described.
You know, Sandy, the more you look at what is transpiring, the more complex. You've always talked about how it's complex. The more you start realizing, hey, even though you see these signs of life in our country, we're not alone. You know, trade partners, all those things, there's no way we're going to be able to decouple ourselves from the rest of those nations. Let's go to the phone lines and Tom from LA. Hey, Tom. Good morning. Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
First off, we the people collectively are the government, and we must never forget that. Second, Sandy, I would just love for you to continue to kind of keep hammering, even if it takes 5 minutes of each show that you're on, about your $64,000 average deal income.
Median income, yeah.
Family.
Yeah.
Median income of a family. So people actually start hearing this and start, you know, one thing that the Republicans are very good at is, as we all know, we have a crazy CJ that does it, every day repeating the same thing over and over again until it actually becomes in the brain, that if you could continue to bring that up, so the rural community and the urban community maybe could actually have some empathy for each other and understand that we're all on the same team, and that the people that are not on the same team are the billionaire class and the money in politics and everything else, and we should be fighting those issues rather than fighting some of the other food fights that we constantly have. And I think the Republicans are showing once again that they can't work their way out of a paper bag. Look at what's happening in Congress right now. And I think people need to know that. But if you could please, just each day that you're on, or even Earl, could just repeat that again and again about very, very simple, you know, the different dollar amounts for each thing, like a whiteboard, and do that. I would really appreciate that.
Well, you know, my hope was in bringing it up in the first place, and I'm really appreciative that you liked it and you talk about it, was that I was surprised that I haven't heard politicians talking about it and talking to the middle class about the very problem that they have, because I'd never really analyzed what constitutes the middle class and what are the issues that we've presented to them. And the fact is that the way that the economic conditions in this country have changed, the middle class today faces a far different budget than the middle class faced in 1970. And the middle class today is comprised of two breadwinners, not one. And so what used to be able to get you into the middle class was a single income. And what now gets you into the middle class is two breadwinner income, which means that each one of those breadwinners is earning less than the median breadwinner earned in 1970, which is a real change in the social fabric of the country. And whereas in 1970, people used to point at the Soviet Union and shake their head with dismay and say they're sending their three-year-olds off to child daycare, and as if that was part of the ideological contest and that was being done to brainwash these kids into the communist system. No, it was really just because they had two parents working, which is now what we have in America across the board. And so... You know, the fact is that the inability of our country to provide universal daycare and universal health care has driven the $64,000 median income Wisconsin family into a deficit before they can even buy clothes or buy a car, because they have to spend, you know, $16,000 a year on average for daycare and $16,000 on average for the health care, even taking advantage of the 8.5% limit on health care premiums under the federal tax law, and then
16,000 in taxes,
14,000 in taxes, and 16,000 in rent. And when you get done with all that, you don't have any money left, and you don't have a car, and you don't have food, and you know we have driven the middle class families into a corner that if they all understood they were in it, they would stop feeling guilty about their inability to handle the money they earn, and realize that the system as it's now set up makes it impossible for them to save for their children's education, to pay off their student debt, to put any savings aside for their, in a 401k for their retirement. We have put the middle class family in the United States behind an eight ball that they can't solve unless politically and governmentally we decide to step forward and do what every other developed country has done.
And if the middle class would actually realize this and stop blaming each other for, you know, teaching certain things in school, or, you know, even LGBTQ rights, or, you know, whatever it might be, if they actually looked at that and said, you know, we're all on the same team, whether you're in the rural area or you're in the urban area or you're in the wherever area, we're all in that same boat. So therefore, everyone out there collectively, look, this is a class war, and we've lost the class war. The billionaire class has won the war. So the thing is, we have to get back to understanding that we, the people, collectively are the government. It's not that you're getting free child care. It's not that you're getting free medical care. It's that you have decided as a society that this is something that's very important for us to actually have a middle class in this country. And I think that if it's approached that way, And again, God, I wish the conservatives would call up and just say, yeah, this person's, you know, living off the government or whatever it might be. You know, you could actually pull aside and say, here's 16,000, 16,000, 14,000, 16,000. And tell me, what is it that you are going to do to survive? Because to me, the only thing that's left is either taking out loans or putting it on a credit card. Or if you're lucky enough and you're part of the lucky sperm club, you know, you got parents that are going to help you out.
Well, I mean,
time goes on, those parents aren't going to have money.
Well,
they're not going to have savings in the future.
That 64,000 is the median family, so half of the families in Wisconsin live below that level.
And that's my point.
And I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it's a class war so much as it is. I'm not sure who's winning this. There are obviously a half of the families who live above it. If you look at the bell curve around that median, it's pretty tight. It's a very small group of people who live way above it. But government has stopped serving the interests of that. It starts serving the interest of interest groups. And is the interest group a class of billionaires?
That's why I've always proposed.
Yeah.
That's why I've always proposed, Sandy, on the on your receipt that you get from.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Dare we?
Yeah, let me just, I guess CJ's on the line.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, let me just, before I've lobbied on your behalf, CJ, to put you on the line, but let me tell you the conditions that I'm lobbying on your behalf about. Number one, we talked about Ukraine, and if you, what you're calling in to say is that the reason that Ukraine happened is because Donald Trump would never have let it happen, and that Putin invaded Ukraine because of the weakness of Joe Biden in backing out of Afghanistan and having 13 servicemen die and leaving behind $85 billion worth of equipment. If that's what you're going to say, I've said it on your behalf, and I don't want you to say it on your own behalf, because you've said it 20 to 30 times on your call-ins. If what you're calling in about is inflation, and what you're going to say is that the reason we have inflation is because we have an all-Democrat government, and the Democrats have spent money in the last 2 years over the opposition of Republicans who said we shouldn't. And, of course, that's all in spite of the fact that the Trump administration before that set the tables for inflation with huge deficits and a big tax reduction. But if that's what you're going to say, then you can't say that either on this call, because I've lobbied on your behalf for you to call in and say something new. So what is it you have to say, CJ?
So wait a minute. Why do we need CJ? We just had him on.
I don't know, but CJ calls in daily and wants to participate in the call. And I'm all for discussions, particularly policy discussions, and I'm particularly interested in if we could have policy discussions and try to develop sort of trusted sources and try to have policy discussions that are not partisan-based and are not designed to... All right, well, I just voted no, CJ.
Listen to you, though, Sandy.
No, I didn't. I wasn't being partisan. I just said don't repeat. I just said don't repeat what you've already said 25 times in 25 earlier calls. Okay.
Who's Larry Summers, Sandy?
I vote no now, because we've heard about Larry Summers. And we've heard what Larry Summers had to say years ago about the expenditures and the concern about whether the incentive the legislation that was adopted bipartisanly, incidentally, that whether it might be inflationary or not. You've said that already, and we weren't talking about the cause of inflation. We've been talking about whether the middle-class family in the United States faces problems. That's what Tom talked about. And the problems the middle-class family, as we said last time you called in, have maybe been exacerbated by inflation, but have not been caused by inflation. Okay? And so if you want to talk about what should be done for the middle-class family to help them solve their budgetary problems, it isn't going to be legitimate to say we need to attack inflation. Number one, inflation has gone down rather dramatically in the time period of our various calls. But number two, the problem wasn't caused by inflation in the first place. So, you know, if what you want to talk about is the issues we've raised—
The inflation rate, CJ, over the last several months is 3%.
Are you kidding me, Earl?
I didn't say since the beginning of last year.
Well,
you asked what it is.
I'm not going to take CJ's bait. I'm not talking about inflation. We weren't talking about inflation. Okay.
You don't do this to anybody else.
Oh, yeah. You know, we know why, CJ, because hardly anybody else behaves like you do.
Here's what I called about, Sandy.
Okay.
You set all these preconditions for me to call.
All right. Well, which one are you going to?
I've never heard you do that for anybody else, but that's okay. How about the mere fact of what's going on in Congress right now is going to help the American people?
Like what?
Because they're setting up rules for Congress. They're trying to prove what's happened in Congress. And the changes that Nancy Pelosi and your party made has destroyed
the middle class. Now wait a minute. Wait a minute, CG. Let's just get factual.
God.
Let's get factual.
I never get the chance to finish my point.
I know.
Go ahead, Sandy.
The rule change that is the first one that was changed was a rule change of the Republican caucus. And the Republican caucus was changing a rule, which was that it took a majority of the Republican caucus to call for a no confidence vote in the speaker. And they changed that to one member of the caucus. That's what the current demand.
No, they changed it to five.
No, the current demand. The current demand is one. It hasn't been met yet.
Yeah.
All right.
But
so,
you try to rewrite history.
No,
Sandy.
I'm not rewriting history. I said
you are.
No, McCarthy
the
agreed.
The fact of everything that you said that I have said 100 times when I've called about Joe Biden is factual. Everything that you said about Afghanistan that I said 100 times is factual.
Okay, that's enough. That's enough.
Because we have other people on the line, and, you know, clearly we tried. You know, he is not allowed on other shows across the network. And so we try to give him a fair shake. But how can you? Right? Because he can't.
Well, the only thing is, I would hope that on this show, the only reason I'm on the show is to try and foster a discussion of issues that is not partisan, okay, and is based on fact. Now, whether the Republican caucus is or the Democratic caucus, right now the facts about what's going on in the Republican caucus are a set of facts, and it isn't because of rules that were set by Nancy Pelosi. All right. And the rules and the changes that are being proposed, for instance, and some of the conditions, like the notion that they would take the United States to the brink of default by refusing to increase the debt limit.
These are things right now.
Yeah, these are not rules that were set and in place by the Democrats and being corrected by the Republicans. So, and that's a partisan slant on it. So, I'm all for calls that raise issues that allow us to talk about facts and explore them and talk about policy and explore them, but not for repetitive calls that are only partisan in nature.
So listen, all of you guys hang on the line. I promise you we'll come back to you on the other side. We've got to go to a break. Hang on, 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.